Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to Pathways, a show featuring conversations with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. Join me, host Paul O'Brien, or my co-host Donald Altman every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. You can find out more about the show or listen to the program archive at kboo.fm/pathway.
I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. The Old Mole's a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial point of view. Today, Desiree Hollegers brings us the conclusion to her segment on memorials for organizer Dan Handelman. First, Fran Michel speaks with Jordan Carr Morse about tonight's preview of his documentary in progress, The Israeli, at the Clinton Street Theater. Here's a segment produced by Fran Michel for the Old Mole Variety Hour and KBOO Community Radio.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Jordan Carr Morse, a director and editor and the founder of Eyes and Ears, a production company committed to forwarding progressive political and social movements. Jordan has worked as a cinematographer and editor on commercials and films that have been screened around the world and is currently directing his first feature-length documentary, The Israeli, about the journey of Israeli-American activist and author Miko Peled from Zionist to Palestinian rights activist. There will be a sneak peek at the work in progress tonight, Monday, July 7th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, and along with that, a screening of Jordan's short film, The Orphan, which follows 90-year-old Holocaust survivor Jacques Boud as he recounts his time in post-war Israel and why his experience with genocide compelled him to the Palestinian cause. That film was directed by Carr Morse and produced by Peled. After the films, there will be a Q&A with the director and a panel discussion featuring local activists. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Jordan Carr Morse.
Thank you so much for having me.
These are both really splendid films. The Orphan is quite beautiful. The Israeli is fascinating, and I really want to see more of it. Peled produced the short film, The Orphan. Can you talk about how you came to meet and work together and make the documentary, The Israeli?
Yeah, sure. I first met Miko working on another film by a Palestinian filmmaker named Ali Al-Aryan, and we interviewed Miko in Washington, D.C. Miko sort of was interested in that work, and he had a funder who wanted to sort of promote his work, and they reach out to me to make some short online explainer videos, sort of Israel-Palestine 101 shorts for YouTube. And so Ollie and Miko and I wrote some scripts that Miko would read, and I flew out to Washington, D.C. to have Miko read these. And we put the scripts up on a teleprompter and started to record, and it sort of just wasn't working that well. So after sort of an hour or so of not being crazy about what we were recording, I ended up throwing the scripts away and just having Miko talk to me. And he ended up, over the course of a couple of days, kind of telling me his whole journey, his whole life story. And what we recorded was probably the most compelling interview I'd ever heard. It was moving. It was something that you could just sit and watch for minutes and minutes at a time, unedited, and just be glued to it. So once we'd done that, we realized we hadn't really made the short explainer videos we had set out to make, but what we had was the basis for a much bigger story. So we took the next several years at this point, sort of reverse engineering that one long form interview into the Israeli, into this film. And that entailed visiting Palestine with Miko a couple of times and touring all across Europe and the United States, sort of following his speaking tour and his journey in order to sort of flesh out that story and bring it to life. So that's how we did it.
So there are parts of the film that you filmed in Palestine and around Europe and Israel. Part of what we see in the Israeli is the experience that Miko has of going into the West Bank, going into Palestinian territory and grappling with his own fears about that, with the difficulty of that experience. What was it like for you as a filmmaker going into places that are quite restricted? I mean, there are checkpoints, there are gates. Were there problems with getting visas? How did you go about going to the West Bank and making the film there?
Yeah, great question. Well, it was a bit of a trick. We went twice in February and then I believe in August of 2022. And this was right on the tail end of COVID, really. Or, well, we were still in the middle of COVID. But as you might recall, Israel was probably the most strict country in terms of restricting travel in and out and movement within the country at that time. So we had scheduled the trip several times and had to cancel it because they would lift the COVID ban and then put it back in place. So it was difficult to get there both times. Oh, I should note also that as a filmmaker, you're not really supposed to go to Israel and make a film. You need official approval from the state in order to bring in a crew and equipment and things like that on paper. So what we decided to do, we knew we weren't going to get that permission given, you know, who Miko is, and he's pretty well known in Israel. So we decided to sort of sneak in. I ended up buying really small kind of mini versions of all the equipment you might need. So microphones and cameras and all little things. So they looked like sort of consumer grade tools that a tourist might bring in just to take photos. So we kind of smuggled that stuff in. But once we got there, it was really fascinating because, you know, you hear stories about how restricted or how dangerous or things like that traveling inside Palestine was. And at that time, at least, I think it's probably changed a lot since then. But when we were there, we actually had really no problem traveling anywhere we wanted to go. And this is something Miko discovered, I think, early on in his journey, that even though he was told his whole life that it was dangerous to visit Palestinian towns and that he was risking his life if he did so, once you go and do it, you realize that that's just not the case at all. I mean, we went all over the place. We went to Hebron. We went to Bethlehem. We traveled all over the West Bank. And what Miko had already known, but what I discovered was that everyone was incredibly welcoming and generous, and we never felt in danger or at risk sort of at all. So, you know, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about what Palestine is and what it's like and who the people are and things like that. I will say that it was a subject that I think I felt I understood on paper. I felt like I had the sort of right politics on it, I guess, going in. But it was a whole other thing to sort of see it for yourself and to see what Palestinians have to live with day to day. I mean, it's really shocking. I mean, the apartheid is just tangible. I mean, you can see it in 1,000 tiny ways every day, from the streets that, you know, they can walk down or can't walk down in their own towns, you know, where their family has lived for generations, to the roads that they can or can't use, to who can marry whom. I mean, they're restricted to travel between different parts of the West Bank by the Israeli occupation. So it's really quite shocking.
So the restrictions on mobility really apply to Palestinians, not to Israelis, not to visitors and tourists.
That's right. That's right. I mean, as a couple of basically white guys, nobody looked twice at us. We could go right through checkpoints. We could drive wherever we wanted. Of course, if you're a Palestinian, that's not at all the case. So yeah, we, you know, I like to think about it in terms of maybe capitalizing on some of our white privilege there to try and tell a story that, you know, makes a difference.
And the process of coming to understand what it's like there, the transition from having a sense of it on paper, of the abstract understanding, to really experiencing it and internalizing it, is something that also seems to be part of Miko Peled's journey. I mean, he goes from having been raised as a Zionist to becoming an advocate for Palestinian rights. And there's a good deal in the film about the difficulty of that process and how it is a process. It's not simply a momentary discovery and enlightenment ensues, but there's a kind of repeated iteration of grappling with his own fears, with his own assumptions, and working through those. Tell us a little bit about Miko's story, where he starts and how he starts to move away from that initial training in Zionist beliefs.
Yeah, Miko's story is fascinating for a number of reasons, but one of them is that his starting point in his journey was, I mean, he wasn't just a Zionist. The founding of the State of Israel for Miko was a family affair. His relatives, his parents, his grandparents, his aunts, his uncles played key roles in the establishment of the Israeli state. His grandfather signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence, and his father was a nationally famous war hero general, was, I believe, the highest ranking military officer that one could be, you know, helped build the IDF. So Miko grew up in the very heart of the sort of Zionist movement, right? His grandparents were some of the first Israelis. So coming from there, I think it made it particularly difficult to get outside of that. And it made it particularly difficult for him to hear stories of Palestinians that clashed with the version of history that he was brought up with. All he was told by the people who lived it was the story of Israel as this heroic effort to make the desert bloom and grow a country from sort of nothing into this booming, industrial, modern, democratic place. And, you know, he had no reason to doubt that, really. I mean, he felt like he owned the truth, that he had lived the truth. There was no debate about it. And the really pivotal point in Miko's story was in the mid-90s, when his 13-year-old niece was killed in a suicide bomb attack by Hamas in Jerusalem. And that obviously rocked everyone's world who was around that. But it changed Miko's life to the point where he needed to seek out and find answers to this. And so for the first time in his life, he went and sought out and started to meet Palestinians. I mean, even though he grew up in Jerusalem, there are plenty of Palestinians, but it's very segregated. So he never really met Palestinians. And as he began to do this, he would hear the stories that the Palestinians would tell and their version of history and what their parents had experienced. And it was not just a little bit different. It was the opposite of what Miko had been brought up believing. And that, you know, that was a tough thing to hear, right? I mean, how do you deal with that? And so for Miko, he describes it as this very slow and painful process, and one that he likens to losing a limb. He had to sort of completely reject so much of his identity and then rebuild it with something else and replace it with something else. And so for Miko, that something else was activism, and was joining the Palestinian cause and eventually devoting his whole life to the Palestinian cause.
It seems like there must have been some movement in the direction of skepticism and exploration and questioning within his family when this happened. There's a scene of his niece's parents being asked about their reaction to the killing, and the journalists clearly expect them to be calling for revenge. These are the children of this great general, and the general's granddaughter has been killed by Hamas, so surely they're going to call for revenge. And her mother, I guess Miko's sister, says, "I don't want any mother to feel this. I don't want revenge." So there, it seems like there's some movement in the family toward questioning, toward thinking about things a little bit differently, even before that bombing.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because Miko's whole family, really, they are liberals. They are liberal Zionists for the most part. And even his father, General Mati Peled, was sort of famous for being anti-war. He always advocated for making peace with the Palestinians. He thought it was foolish, much of what Israel was doing in terms of continuously expanding and dominating the Palestinians. And, you know, a lot of his family was on the same page. I mean, they were skeptical of a lot of what might call the excesses of more recent regimes in Israel. But, you know, this is one of the subtler points the film explores, which is that a lot of people will tell Miko that they agree with him on, you know, 90 or 95% of what he says, but that he goes too far. And a big part of Miko's story was rejecting even the liberal form of Zionism and realizing that the entire project of Zionism is flawed, that it has racism essentially built into the very foundation of it. And in order to overcome that, in order to actually sort of get right with his own morality, he had to reject this project entirely. And that process is something that has alienated Miko from his liberal Zionist family. they see him as now having gone way too far, and they sort of see him as anti-Semitic and hateful and things like that. So there was a skepticism, you know, there was a very liberal tendency within his family even before this event, but that event really set Miko on a path that would see him compelled to oppose Zionism at its most fundamental level. And that's really the point of the story, I think. I mean, it's that Miko's story is one that I think will help a lot of people who are on the fence on this issue, you know, help them move off the fence and realize that the problem is not Netanyahu, you know, not extreme religious forms of Zionism. The problem is Zionism, full stop, just the whole project.
So if his development and changes have alienated him from his family, does that include the liberal Zionist family is not accepting of his rejection of Zionism?
Well, you know, I think, you know, his relationship, I think, really frayed in the wake of October 7th. So in the wake of October 7th, we were seeing all of these stories very uncritically spread in Western media about, you know, mass rape and mass murder and the sort of craven behavior that Palestinians who were attacking from Gaza were committing. And Miko was very skeptical of these stories right from the outset. As some of the most sensationalist stories were appearing in the press, Miko was very publicly saying, I don't believe this. We shouldn't believe the Israeli state. I mean, when they tell us what's happening, we should know better. And, you know, he was familiar enough with who these attackers were. I mean, with, you know, who Hamas is and who the Palestinian militants were, that he didn't really buy whole cloth a lot of these stories like a lot of people did. And he's been proven correct on that. I mean, we've seen a lot of debunking of a lot of those stories. But in the wake of that traumatic event for the Israeli population, any sort of skepticism or any sort of apology or defense of Palestinians broadly was seen as just really offensive. Miko was publicly casting doubt on some of these stories and still talking about his deep and steadfast commitment to Palestinian freedom, right? Which is the real thing we ought to be talking about in relation to October 7th. His family basically disowned him for that. They saw him as a sort of Holocaust denier, as an anti-Semite. And as far as I'm aware, at least, I mean, the last time I spoke to Miko about it, he essentially is not in contact with his family in Israel anymore. And on top of that, he has been advised that he should not return to Israel. They've changed some of the laws and made some of the things Miko was saying now treasonous. So, you know, Miko can't go home. And that's quite a sacrifice to make for his beliefs. And so, yeah, you'll see all that in the movie.
Yeah, I'm struck by some of the parallels between U.S. developments and Israeli developments. And he talks about having grown up on the privileged side of this divide. And there were Palestinians in his environment, but they didn't seem like people. They were the construction workers and the gardeners and doing certain kinds of labor that immigrants often do in the U.S., that there was this category of people who were not really seen as human, who were dirty and sick and lazy. And he comments that the term in Hebrew for bad workmanship is Arab workmanship. That is sort of tremendous propaganda against that group. So to then make the transition to getting to know Palestinians and to understanding their experience and realizing that they did not leave voluntarily, which he apparently had been taught and believed at one point, is quite a striking journey. And there are striking parallels with some of the messaging that we're getting in the U.S. So that Israel, in its exclusion of him, in its constraints on free speech, seems to be just a few steps ahead of the direction that the U.S. may be moving at this point. So these are lessons for activists, for viewers of the film, things that can help us come to understand what's going on there, how we are ourselves potentially implicated in this. Can you talk about the role that you see for cinema and for documentary in helping to move people and raise awareness and contribute to change in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that compelled me to do both of these stories, both Miko's story and Jacques' story, is that they are both perspectives that I think cut through a lot of the noise, a lot of the propaganda that we're exposed to in this country, especially. These are both Jewish people who have deep experiences with the history of Zionism and, you know, are speaking about it from a position of deep understanding. I mean, they lived these stories. And what I find so compelling about them is that I think, you know, they're really powerful tools for moving people who might be on the fence off of the fence. If you had any sort of doubts about what the state of Israel and the project of Zionism are really about, these stories can really inform you. these two stories can really inform you. And in terms of Miko's story, his story really mirrors, I think, the process that a lot of Americans also have to go through. The parallels are pretty striking. I mean, it's a story about realizing that where you grew up and the things that you were told to value and believe are not what they seem. These are both settler colonial countries, and it's sort of about waking up to what that means. And, you know, the parallels in terms of the sort of racism and othering of particular ethnic groups, I think all stem from that process. How is this country built? Who is it built for? And what does that mean for prospects of democracy and justice and things like this? You know, Miko, because I think he's gone through that process that a lot of Americans have to go through. I think it's really resonant for an American audience. I mean, he's speaking to everyday Americans who are not necessarily initiated in this. He starts from scratch. He starts from the same starting point that Americans have to start with on this issue. We're just sort of born into this culture where Zionism is just sort of accepted without question. We're just told Israel is the noble project, and that the Israelis are the good guys and the Palestinians are the bad guys and the terrorists. And, you know, a lot of people never really question that. So Miko's story, I think, really speaks to, you know, everybody's aunt and mom and uncle and anybody who is maybe starting out where we all start out. Right. And that's where I think these stories can be helpful. I mean, there are a lot of great films that have been made on this topic, a lot, especially just in the last couple of years. But what I'm hoping that these films can do is really try and reach a broader audience who maybe don't know the first thing about any of this, and sort of bring folks up to speed in a way that they can relate with. And, you know, I think that broader project is just really critical right now. I mean, I think it's becoming clearer every day that Zionism is a force that needs to be confronted. It's controlling politics in this country, right? I mean, it's the reason Donald Trump is president. It's the reason we're going to war with Iran. These are deeply tied to Zionism. So I don't know how we get out of this exactly, but I know that growing a movement of people who see clearly what's happening and are motivated to act is where we start.
And what are the next steps for the Israeli? And you're working on this film in addition to the interviews that you've done with Miko, with others. There's archival footage. Where is the process of completing the film?
Thank you. So we are currently in post-production. So we've filmed everything we're going to film. And we are now in the process of putting the final touches on the edit. And then we've got things like music production and licensing of archival materials and legal clearances and all the sort of boring stuff that goes into really finishing a film that can be released broadly. So what we're trying to do with this screening is to start to raise funds to get this done and get it out. This is very much an independent project. You know, something to note is that this film was largely a sort of one-man band sort of project. I mean, I was the camera person and the director and the sound recordist and the editor and yada yada. So it was basically me with a little camera following Miko around for a couple of years. We didn't have much money, and this screening is to kind of kickstart our crowdfunding campaign and hopefully put us in a position where we can get this thing finished and out to a broad audience within the next 6 months or so.
Great. Tickets are only $10 at the Clinton Street and will benefit that project of getting those clearances and getting things licensed and so on. And again, so Monday, July 7th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, The Israeli sneak peek and the short film, The Orphan. There will be a Q&A after the film, as well as a panel discussion with local activists. Thank you so much for talking with us, Jordan Carr Morse.
Thank you, Fran. I really appreciate it.
The road is long.
He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, as rendered by the incomparable Hollies. And you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. Up next, the second of a two-part segment produced by Desiree Helligers, featuring audio excerpts from recent memorial services for organizer Dan Handelman, who died in April at age 60. Here's Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
The audio for the June 28th memorial service at Clinton Street Theater begins with the voice of Barb Green, Dan's partner of 30 years, animal rights and environmental activist, and longtime member of Flying Focus Video Collective, Peace and Justice Works, and Portland Cop Watch.
There's been a little change to the program. It says that my tribute was going to be read by Shelley, but I thought it would be strange for her to stand up here and say, Dan was the love of my life. I'd feel a little odd about that. Thank you all so much for coming today to celebrate the life of Dan. It's wonderful to see so many of the people he loved in one spot. Actually, I can't see you, but I know you're out there. I'm sure you've all heard stories about people who died and came back and said that while they were technically dead, they floated up and looked down on what was going around. I'm thinking there's a good chance that Dan is up there right now, looking down on us. I mean, Dan Handelman wouldn't miss a meeting, would he? So I'd appreciate it if you all would join me in saying hi. We love you, Dan. Hi, Dan. We love you. Thank you so much. I feel very grateful and privileged to have had Dan in my life for 30 years. He was my life partner, my person, my boo, the love of my life. I wasn't sure I'd get that far. I'm glad I did. We shared a love of peace and justice, cats, cemeteries, crossword puzzles, theater and movies, places like the Peculiarium. Hey, he wanted this to be a happy occasion, which reminds me of Dr. Seuss, who said, "Don't be sad that he's gone, be happy that he was here." Mm-hmm. Yep. Actually, I think he was talking about an ice cream cone, but the principle's the same. By the way, we had a practice of picking a word for the day every morning from some cards I made to try and start the day on a positive note. And they're right down there by the toilet paper. And the word for today is be happy. Dan wanted people to be happy here. He wanted this to be a joyful, not a sad occasion. Dan and I learned a lot from each other. He taught me video editing and how to change the spark plugs on my Toyota and keep it running for 37 years. Not as long as his, but close. I taught him how to take care of cats and cook vegan food. I learned about the prevalence of police abuse from him, and he learned about animal rights from me. He was very, very smart. He was an amazing organizer, a fluent speaker and writer on many complicated subjects. I was in awe of the amount of words that could come out of that man, as I'm sure anybody who's read the People's Police Report can attest to. He could make tax returns for corporations entertaining. Alice Walker said, "Resistance is the secret of joy," which I ponder. I'm not sure I get it. Dan called his latest car Joy. I don't remember why. If anybody knows, please let me know. Another quote that Dan lived by is this one: "May evil beware, and may good dress warmly, and eat plenty of vegetables." And that, of course, is the superhero, the Tick. I have a passage somewhere that I can't find right now from a book co-written by the Dalai Lama. The gist is that research shows when people are happy, they are more accepting of others and more peaceful. His conclusion is that if we want the world to be a better place for everyone, it is our duty to be happy. So I know things are dire out there, but Dan wants us to be happy. Dr. Seuss wants us to be happy. The Dalai Lama says it's our duty to be happy. So I guess maybe we should be happy. So be kind, get in good trouble, and you guys have fun out there.
Next to speak was Matt Handelman, Dan's younger brother by a year. 8 months before Dan died, his older brother, David Handelman, died. You can look for an article in Rolling Stone magazine about David. Here's Matt.
The number of people who have told me how many letters that they saved, typewritten letters that Dan wrote them years and years ago. One of your college buddies, Dan, found one of them and wrote something so touching to me and so right on the nose that I couldn't say it better, so I thought I'd read it to you here. This is something we've discussed a bit, our small college crowd, how Dan was when we first knew him. Not that focused on social change and political issues. An incredibly generous, giving, and kind-hearted person. The ingredients were all there, but not, at that point, as involved as he would later become. I remember with some clarity how Desert Storm affected Dan. He was really worried about a high school friend of his who had been called up to serve. I had never heard him react like that before to something in the news, a geopolitical event. He was really, really rocked by it all. It is the Dan I knew and was honored to know in the most formative years of my life. And yet, it leaves me with an extra bit of sadness. In the decades to follow, he chose a hard path to walk.
Activist, oral historian, and playwright Donna Hayes, whose 17-year-old grandson, Quanis Hayes, was killed by the Portland police in 2017.
I met Dan at a city council meeting. This man didn't know me. I didn't know him. But he sat right beside me and spoke for my family, dealing with police accountability. I thought this was the smartest man alive. The things that rolled out of his mouth was just amazing. And I had to follow him ever since then. I went to some of his protests. I got an email quite often from him. And I read every last one of them. Because to me, this was the smartest man alive. He, just sitting across from me and listening to him speak for my family that he never met a day in his life. He was just awesome, great. Well, we did have some disagreements too. It wasn't always paradise. Him and my nephew had clashes because my nephew had a tendency to support the police in certain matters that Dan didn't agree with. And I didn't get an email, I got a telephone call. And he told me, your nephew was diluting the whole thing. And here I am trying to explain my nephew's side. He didn't want to hear it. And I didn't care, as long as he didn't abandon me. Okay, if he want to step out on my nephew, go right ahead. I do it too. But he had a passion for social justice that I don't think nobody on the planet to this day has. He believed wholeheartedly, deep in his soul, about fighting for what is right. And he was one of the reasons why I stand up and fight. Because I watched this man that didn't know me, spoke for me and my family, and stood up for my family, do it. I had no other choice. I wanted to be like Dan. And I kept wondering who would want to be like Dan. He was great. And what broke my heart was when I got the telephone call. And I felt like my whole world just was ripped apart. But it wasn't, because I got every email, I saved them, that Dan ever sent me. And I can go back and read it and still say, nobody can take his place. I don't think nobody is smart as he is. And I'm so glad and honored that he was my friend. Thank you.
Activist Charlie Michelle Wesley.
So I didn't prepare anything because I was going to read a poem that he was really fond of, that he recently saw a PC had recorded me reciting that poem at a recent protest. I had my corner too, just like Dan does. And then I decided, well, it's not really fitting for this particular setting, so I wrote a poem last night real quick. It just seemed more personal to the relationship that Dan and I had. And for those of you who don't know, I'm Charlie Michelle Wesley. I'm a tribal member of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, this on our stolen land. And I would just like to say, welcome all my peaceful people, as Dan would say on the corner every Friday. He would refer to us as his peaceful people. And every time we would go march around downtown for 30 minutes, we would stop at the parking structures, especially when the doors were open, and he would encourage us all to shout out, "No war!" because it would echo through the parking structure. And I want to introduce my poem in a way that you get to know our relationship. And so we were very adamant about justice. You know, there just seemed to be, everywhere you turn, injustices. And we both agree that wherever there's injustice, there's something to do. And I think that's why him and I are both so busy all the time. Fighting injustice seems to be a full-time job. And I just can't imagine ever just stepping back and going, I'm done. You know, just like Dan. He would have never been done with this fight, unfortunately. And we had some other things in common, like duct tape. I don't know if you've seen his gloves, but they're duct taped together. He won't buy new gloves, and you can't even give him new gloves. He wants his duct taped gloves, right? And I use duct tape for everything. In fact, one of my bracelets just broke, and so I mended it with black duct tape. So, and I was thinking about Dan the whole time I was doing that. Every time one of my kitties, because I had three cats that were aging out all in the same year, they passed away, and every time I would share that with him, you know, he had such compassion about that for me and just was very sympathetic. I was kind of surprised that he was a cat person, but he definitely is, and I appreciated that. So many times, like, we met on the Police Accountability Commission, and I just felt I was chosen for lived experience, and I was chosen for my activism, but I felt so very out of place because it seemed like most of the people on the Police Accountability Commission were so knowledgeable of the ins and outs of the injustice system that I call the policing and the way things are run. And I tried to quit several times. And he recognized something in me I didn't recognize in myself. He felt my voice was very, and my lived experience was very valuable to this process of creating a system that would actually hold the police accountable. And I really appreciated that. And I've also seen the side of him that when he couldn't get the entire Police Accountability Commission and our project manager to agree on something, or like the city attorney, et cetera. He would get so frustrated, and he would just pound away at that, and he was going to make these people understand why this is so important. And I could actually see how important it was. His dedication to bringing about justice and police accountability in other areas was very impressive. And I appreciated it as a BIPOC person who is often targeted by the police. And you don't even have to be targeted for doing a crime. It feels like they look at you because of the color of your skin first, and then they'll find a crime. Every time I would do public testimony to city council, I do some pretty radical truth telling up there. And he would always just be, good job, Charlie. Good job. You know, speaking truth to power. Just one other quick thing. I never heard him curse. That was something he was not fond of. Finally, the one time I think he spewed every word he had been holding in for his lifetime was actually when my comrade and friend Dog, who was shot at Normandale, decided to die with dignity, and he just let it rip. It just tore him up that, you know, this was a white supremacist attack on a Black Lives Matters protest. And so he took two lives, but he has really damaged so many of us who were there emotionally. Yeah, he did have a huge heart. Anyway, here's what I wrote for Dan last night. I named it Because You Were You. Searching for guidance in fear and desperation, not knowing where to turn, I received an invitation. You're accepted to the Police Accountability Commission. I was like, what the? And out of respect for Dan, I won't finish that thought. I anxiously attended the meetings and noticed this very knowledgeable old white guy. Ultimately, through our shared courage, we connected. My severe lived experience and his confidence, no doubt. He repeatedly answered my 5,000 plus questions, and I tried patiently to correct his whiteness. And I'm sure my language hurts his tender ears, definitely challenged his endearing uptightness. But ultimately, we became a valuable team. His expansive police knowledge and quest for peace, and my traumatic life of police violence and justice dream. And finally, I would just like to say, the world is definitely a better place, Dan, because you were you. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Debbie Iona, a longtime volunteer with the League of Women Voters of Portland. I first met Dan in 2000 when I participated in Mayor Katz's work group examining the city's first police oversight system. I was new to the issue, but as time went on, I figured out that Dan would be a helpful resource. That was the start of a 25-year relationship as colleagues and eventually as friends. I came to appreciate Dan's many strengths and how they contributed to his highly effective advocacy on police accountability. He knew policy inside and out. Not only did he know all the intricacies of Portland's system, he also knew other possibly more effective approaches from other jurisdictions. He benefited from an encyclopedic memory. We were regular attendees at police-related meetings. So at times, I saw questions come up that committee members and city staff could not answer. But if someone said, I'll bet Dan knows, he almost always had the answer. He made it a point to connect individually to people involved in the issues, identified what was important to them, and find common ground. He was also an extraordinary organizer and could assemble a group of advocates on a particular issue and turned them out, so we made an impact. I worked with him on both police accountability and the city's relationship with the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. There were some hearings over the years where we had an overwhelming turnout, and I credit Dan for reaching out, providing guidance, and persuading us to commit to showing up and stating our case. These strengths were a huge asset during our service on the Police Accountability Commission. The commission was assigned to figure out the details of Portland's new accountability system. We held all our meetings on Zoom, so it was much more challenging to connect with members individually. Dan devoted time and attention to reaching out and building a relationship with each member. His efforts paid off. The commission presented a unanimous recommendation to City Council, and even when the commission had ended its work, Dan worked to maintain the connections we built so we could continue to advocate for the empowered civilian accountability system we had designed. It is a tribute to him that after his death, we came together to join Charlie and at the Friday rally and are contributing to bricks in his memory near his corner at Pioneer Courthouse Square. Dan could also be amusing and subversive. During Mayor Wheeler's term in office, he did not take testimony on reports. That ended our practice of testifying on the JTTF annual reports. One year, Dan came up with the idea of holding a mock hearing in front of City Hall. We set up a table and chairs with name tents for council members and took turns testifying to the empty chairs. The media covered it, and we probably got more attention that way than if Mayor Wheeler had allowed us to speak. Yeah. So the next year was COVID, I think. We live streamed the city council meeting that was all virtual then and did like a mystery science theater where there was live commentary. Yeah, so, you know, he was definitely, the theater came out, you know, from time to time. In addition to my gratitude for having had the privilege of working with Dan for over 25 years, we became friends. As many of you know, Dan did not readily share details of his personal life, but over time, he and I started sharing personal stories with one another or speaking informally about the news of the day. Sometimes when he was packing up the office, he'd give me a quick call just to chat. Now, when the phone rings at certain times of the day or evening, my first thought is that it must be Dan. I, along with all of you, I miss him terribly. Thank you.
Videographer, activist, and co-founder of the Flying Focus Video Collective, PC Perry.
So this is stream of consciousness and no prepared speech. One of the things that I think about Dan and his efforts is the myth of Sisyphus. And I once gave him a birthday present that was very small, but I think said pretty much what I saw going on. It was a little rock, probably about that size, very smooth on the outside, probably rolled with water in the tides. But in the center of it, it had a wash where water had hollowed out this hard stone. The water didn't stop. It made an impression. So did Dan. Now let me add some of my own feelings. We have a tyrant trying to work his way into our government, our souls, our lives. And I want you to do something that kind of annoyed me. When Dan died, many people rallied around to say how good he was, how much good he did. I want you to take his work to your hands and make it not a myth, but do something about it. If for no other reason, it's your life that's on the line. So Dan was obsessive, and it's a good thing he was. Tenacious, yeah, but obsessive. Nobody else would have thought that they could reverse the ways of international disorder, change the police. And I'm also reminded of something we had in common, which was when we saw the Rose Parade come to town, and they would bring the boats out in the river and have the fireworks. We knew that people who had actually been in war did not see that as entertainment. PTSD, all over again. Don't let Dan Handelman be a memory that you hold up like Dr. King. Oh, one day we will have, no, make it happen.
My name is Mark Chassie. My brother, James Chassie Jr., was beaten by the Portland police to death on September 17th, 2006. I first learned about what happened to Jim the next evening. It was an emotional and disorienting. I couldn't believe it. I soon found stories where the city and the police said Jim was homeless, extremely violent, and urinating in public across from Pearl District diners. I knew immediately they were lying. Jim lived in a nearby apartment, and he was painfully shy and a pacifist. These weren't just lies, they were an offense to my brother's entire existence, his humanity, who he was. The propaganda about Jim compounded the grief. It was like the city and the police were defiling my brother's grave after they had just put him in it. The evening's news promised to have more information. There were witnesses. Then a reporter interviews this guy named Dan Handelman from Portland Cop Watch. He talked about other recent police encounters that resembled what he'd heard about Jim. Dan gave me hope that someone else got it. Someone knew that what they were saying about Jim might not be true. I met Dan soon after at my brother's funeral. I was comforted by his sincerity, kindness, and empathy. I was also completely floored by his vast knowledge about policing issues in Portland. As more information came out that contradicted the propaganda, Dan provided more context. He also helped connect us with a community that was upset and outraged about what had happened to Jim, helping to organize a citizens' committee and public events. Dan was an unbelievable help at a horrible time. Speaking about my brother and what happened to him is hard for me, even when it's been almost 19 years. It's incredible that Dan would voluntarily reach out to help people he didn't know in the midst of personal tragedy. Of course, the work took a toll on Dan. He was a very empathetic person. The media and the public knew Dan mainly for his public advocacy, but he was also an amazing person.
And I've had the privilege of knowing him for almost 30 years. And it's always been him showing up to support families of loved ones who have been lost at the hands of police. I will say he was the humblest man I've ever met. He would never show up and go, "I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch." He would show up with his red wagon, his protest signs, his megaphone, and he would show up any place people wanted him to be. To me, that's a true community hero. Someone who doesn't ask what position somebody's in, A community member needs help. A community member needs information. A community member needs to know that the community will stand up and support them. I loved working with Dan. We spent so many hours talking to the Department of Justice around how are we going to fix what's broken in our system. And I can honestly say over 30 years, I had never heard him say, "This we should just give up and just go home because this is like useless." I would say that sometimes. Why are we still doing this? This is absolutely useless. And he would go, "No, we have to keep pushing. We have to keep pushing." I heard someone ask you this a little earlier, and I'm going to ask you on behalf of Dan, please don't ignore the new Police Oversight Commission. Please don't ignore the new city council, right? None of us can fill the role that Dan did, but each of us can take a piece of the work that he worked on and make a commitment that we're not gonna let that work die. It is too important, too vital, and too necessary.
You've been listening to audio of the June 28th Memorial Service for Dan Handelman, co-founder of Peace and Justice Works, Portland Cop Watch, and Flying Focus Video Collective. When we post the show, we will also post a link to the June 29th Memorial for Dan at Allen Temple CME Church. The video features comments from the Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes and from the Reverend Mark Knudsen, along with comments from Ashley Albies and Debbie Iona, with vocals from Marilyn Keller. This has been Desiree Hilligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for the 7th of July, 2025. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Fran Michelle and her guest Jordan Carr Morse, whose film previews tonight at the Clinton Street, and to Desiree Hilligers for her segment on Dan Handelman. Links to the memorial will be posted on our page at KBOO. In fact, you can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in time, all at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the KBOO website at kboo.fm.
Michael Van Cleek. I'm tapped into the vibe and the rhythm of the river of the city of Portland, and you are too, because you're listening to KBOO Portland.